Okay. So, I'd like to go ahead and get started. First of all, let me ask you, we had Monday's recitation Monday, right? How'd it go?
It was good.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
How long did it go?
Hour 15 maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then just a reminder that I've posted a bunch of reading for this week, so you want to do that. Any questions? Any issues? Yeah.
Would that reading be
The reading from last week is sort of what we're talking about in recitation this week. And my aim is to put stuff on next week's recitation about this week's reading. Yeah. Okay, so last time we talked about a bunch of stuff, and among those things, we talked about the variables that are used in the world of physics to describe the motion of things. And physics is a science aimed at trying to understand the universe around us, generally in a fairly reductionist way of looking at things as simply as possible. Sometimes people call it physics of measurement. I don't know. I mean, in the end, if you could really know this information for a body, you basically know everything there is to know about that body as a function of history. So a lot of physics boils down to trying to understand the position, the velocity, the acceleration of a body as a function of time. And so just a reminder, so this is a position. We live in three dimensions, so if you really want to specify the position of an object, you actually have to have three numbers, not just one. But if you're just in one dimension, then you only need the one. It turns out that the motion is independent in all three dimensions, and I'll actually do a demo to show that in a few minutes. The acceleration is the change in the velocity with respect to time, or the change in the speed. Those both are acceleration. Just there's the thing to remind you is that there's a difference between speed and velocity, speed being the magnitude of velocity being the same thing as speed except it includes the directional information. So a little bit of a subtle difference between speed and velocity that, if you're doing lots of problems, is very important. Hopefully won't be that important for us. Now, the thing is, you might wonder what causes these things to change and how do these things get tied together? I mean, what's the complication? And the issue really comes in because particles actually interact with other things. There are forces of nature which cause things to move, basically, and cause interactions between things. And so to understand motion, you really have to understand how Newton's laws fit into everything, because this describes how the acceleration can change and how that's related to different forces. So, in fact, you might ask, okay, what is a force? And so let me ask that. What is a force?
Like something that acts on something else.
Something that acts on something else.
To make it move or doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, when you're reading it, it
says what?
It says it's like a push or pull, is there a done object?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah.
And also in the reading it says like it just causes acceleration.
Yeah, so Newton quantifies it here. This second law says that if you have a net force, although it's carefully disguised with the symbols that are around it, but basically it's the sum of all the forces is equal to the mass of the object times the acceleration. So a way to think of that is if an object accelerates, there is a force on it, and if it has a force on it, then it will accelerate. I mean, that's a way to think about it. If a net force, okay, you can have two forces. I can be standing in the middle of the football field and some big tackle comes and hits me. He exerts a force on me and clearly will accelerate me, right? But if I get squashed between two of them, the same size, hit me with the same speed, I mean, I'm a mess, but I don't actually have an acceleration because the two forces basically cancel out. So that's what I mean by when I say that force is a vector, we're not going to get too hung up on vectors, but it basically means it has directional aspect to it as well. So I can get pushed on with a force of a certain magnitude here, which would nominally accelerate me in that direction because they're both vectors. I have to include the directionality. And if I have another force going this way, that's the same magnitude, it cancels this one, so that directional piece will actually cancel out. So it's a bit more complicated than just algebra, but do we have...
Yeah.
Are we good?
It was just like force.
Okay.
Force between two strings.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering...
Okay.
All right, so... Okay, hold on a second, I'm not ready to do this yet. But I'm good, I know how to do this.
Okay, but so. Before you just... turn the air and make sure it is smooth running or move, or whether I just change it a little bit. That's all.
Okay.
And that's why I need burn.
All right. Yeah.
And the other one, you know, you press it down.
Yep. Okay, I've done them. Thanks.
Oh, we have photo games. Turn on this one.
Okay, so that's off. That's off right now?
Yeah,
okay.
Okay, photo game.
Okay. Thanks, King. Okay, so that's the basic idea of a force. And of course, you can imagine all sorts of forces. You can push on things, you can throw a rope to somebody and you can pull on it, and that can exert a force on them. So it's anything that could, in principle, cause an acceleration. Now, we're going to talk a lot about the fundamental essence of forces. The forces that you run into typically on a daily basis, you think of as things like somebody's pushing somebody or a rope pulling or a spring pushing or something like that. If you really want to get down to it and you get at the very fundamental essence of what the force actually is, let us imagine we have a box that's sliding on the floor. There is a force on it because if you get it sliding, it will actually slow down. And it will slow down because, well, you say, well, it's because of the friction on the floor. That's true. So what is the friction if you start to think about it? At a microscopic level, the floor is actually quite uneven, no matter how carefully you polish it. The box is also uneven. So the two surfaces going across each other basically are having to rip pieces apart and sort of bounce around and everything, and this will actually use up energy and cause the thing to slow down, and we call it glibly the force of friction. There's also more than that. It turns out that matter is made up of electrically charged particles, and charged particles, which we're going to talk a lot about, and charged particles of different electrical charge will actually attract each other. So you will actually have small bits of electrical attraction between two surfaces, which can cause things to slow down. So in the end, it turns out, if I push on this, it's basically pushing back at me, so I'm not accelerating, but there's a force on me. There's the force of gravity that's pulling me down, and then there's the force of this thing on me. What is that actual force? I mean, in the end, it turns out to be the molecules of the wood pushing against the molecules of my hand, and really the fundamental force that's holding these things together is electromagnetic in nature. It's the electrical charge between the nuclei and the atoms and the electrons in the atoms and the binding between the different nuclei. So we're going to talk a bit about that stuff. But in the end, the essence of the force of this thing on me is actually electromagnetic in nature. So it turns out that if we go and look at all the possible things that happen in nature and try to understand the essence of those forces, we know of only four, we call them the fundamental forces of nature. And we'll talk a good bit about them through the course of the term. One is the force of gravity, one is the force of electromagnetism, one is called the strong nuclear force, and one is called the weak nuclear force. And we'll come back to that, but I just want to sort of lay that out there so that to a physicist, there are actually only four forces in nature. But if you're doing a problem or you're doing a practical thing in the world, you may talk about other forces like the force of friction or the force of a rope on something or a spring, and those all boil down to basically one of these fundamental forces. Okay. So let me illustrate a few bits of this. Actually, before I do that, why don't we were talking about space. So we've talked a bit about dimensions of space. So to really locate something in the world in which we seem to live, it takes three numbers, right? I gave my favorite example is a corn nuts. You know, it's how many aisles down, how far down the aisle, and then what shelf. Those are the three numbers you need. And one of the strange things is that if you do a kinematics variable analysis, if you're actually analyzing the position of something as a function of time, and you're doing it with respect to forces, it turns out that one of the cool things is that these dimensions all basically are independent. And I want to give you an example of that here. So what I have is a cart that can go back and forth. And in addition, I have a spring-loaded device that basically kicks a ball straight up. And it doesn't usually land perfectly in here, but it pretty much lands right where it came up. So the spring is loaded, and there's a little switch here that it goes by, which will cause the spring to kick. And it comes right back down where it was, okay? So that is one dimensional motion, all right? There's one force involved, which is the force of there's the force of the spring, which gets the ball going. But once the ball is in the air, there's one force involved, which is the force of gravity, headed down. So let me ask you a question. What is the speed, or what is the velocity of this thing look like as a function of time? Yeah.
It would look like a bell curve.
A bell curve. Well, the position as a function of time looks like a bell curve, sort of. The velocity would look like what? Let's see. The velocity starts out large and going up in one direction. And then it slows to zero, and then it turns around and goes the other way and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So let me think about that. So if we were to just look at x as a function of time, where I'm defining x to be up and down, then it starts at small x and you do time this way. So it starts at zero. We'll define the zero of the x position to be where the ball starts, and let's only worry about it after the spring has sort of let it go, so it's starting to fly through the air. So it is going to look something like this, because it comes back to where it was. It goes up to a certain point, stops, and then comes back to where it was. So that's a lot like a bell curve. And then if we look at the velocity as a function of time, the velocity will start out very big because it's moving fast at the bottom and it's got a certain sign, which means it's going up one way, right? And then it gets less and less and less, goes to zero, and then goes and gets faster and gets larger and larger. Turns out the velocity will look something like this. Starts out high, slows down to zero, and then gets bigger and bigger, but going the other way. So that's what you mean when you have a negative sign. What about the acceleration? Acceleration is the change in velocity with respect to time. What do you think?
Be like a year. If time is on the
okay.
X-axis.
Anybody else? What do you think? Why do you say that? Okay. If I give a test in physics 113, 60% of the students will say that because I think that's the intuition we all have. The thing is, somehow we don't have an intuition about acceleration, and the only intuition I know of in acceleration is really goes back down to force. F equals ma. F is just the force of gravity, and it turns out we haven't really gotten into the force of gravity here, but because the Earth isn't changing and the distance here isn't changing very much, and we haven't really talked about how those things are all related, the force of gravity is actually constant. So the acceleration is constant, and that's what's causing this velocity. This is not a laser pointer. That is what's causing the velocity to actually change in its sign here. So if you've been into calculus or can stretch way back to some of the really annoying math you had in high school, this change in v is the slope, okay? And the slope, I drew it constant because the force of gravity is constant. Now, okay, so we have a motion, which maybe I've gone on too long about, in one dimension here, which... there's one force like this. This is a pretty good cart. It's got wheels, so there isn't a lot of force this way. There's a little bit of friction, but not much. The wheels will sort of remove the friction. So that means if I go like this, it's slowing down a little bit, but not much. Okay? And when the ball's in the air, again, there might be a little bit of air friction from the movement of the ball, but pretty much there's no force. So that means if the ball is moving with a certain velocity this way, that should not change in this dimension because there's no force in that dimension. All right? So what we have is a force this way, and we'll have a certain motion here in one dimension, and then we'll have no force this way, and we'll have a motion due to that, which means basically should be constant. So let's see what happens when we do them both at the same time. What'd you see? Do it one more time. Yeah.
The ball's moving in two dimensions.
It's moving in two dimensions. So we have this motion and this motion superimposed. So they're actually independent of one another and they're happening at the same time. Which I guess is another way of thinking about dimensions. The motion in the different dimensions is actually independent. Okay, so that's one characteristic of space and dimensions, and we're not going to get too hung up doing problems and stuff with it, but you begin to see some of the subtleties with the various kinematic variables. Here I have aluminum carts that are molded to fit a certain shape on this track, and typically, I mean, I can push with a little force here. I don't want to do a big force because I'll just scratch the track. But they're not going to move very easily, right? Because there's a lot of friction there. But then, just like in an air hockey game, this track has a lot of little holes where I can now let air go through. So if I let air go through and I push just a little bit, these two are tied together, so it's a little bit, let me do a single cart. If I push just a little bit, it moves very nicely because there's no friction. Okay? These two carts are currently tied together with a spring between them. And I'm going to burn the little string that ties them together. So what's going to happen is I'll have two carts with a spring exerting a force. Okay? And we're going to illustrate Newton's third law, really, which is for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, which is if the left-hand cart is pushing through the spring on the right-hand cart is pushing through the spring on the left-hand cart. If they're exerting a force on one another, they will exert an equal force. It'll be an equal acceleration. If their masses are the same, they should move apart from one another at about the same velocity. You okay with that? Because they're going to be accelerated about the same. See, the motion's about the same, except that one hit a spring and this one didn't. So, let me try now. I want to do the same thing. But now I'm going to put a lot more. Well, it was my intent to put a lot more mass on one of these. Okay, so now I'm going to do the same thing, but now I'm going to put much more mass on one of them. All right, so now the spring is going to be pushing with the same force on each of them over the same amount of time. That means the forces should be the same on each. Okay? A moment ago, because they had the same mass, same forces on them, they moved away basically with the same velocity because they had the same force over the same time. So I get the same acceleration, which is change in velocity with respect to time. Start with zero, I get a certain velocity then. So if they have the same force over the same time, they'll move away at about the same speed. So that's what I hope you saw. Now I'm going to give more mass to one of them. And how do you think things will go now?
It's the second law of motion. It's more mass equals the less acceleration.
Right, so F equals ma. I'll have the same force on each of them over the same time, but because the mass on one is much bigger, its acceleration will be less. F equals ma. If m is big, a is small. So this one is going to, the one with a lot of mass should accelerate a lot less than the one with the mass that's unchanged. All right, you ready? Drum roll, please. See? You guys are a hard audience. All right. Okay, so we basically saw some examples of all of this. All right, so that's Newton's laws. Now, why do we care? Basically, if you take Newton's laws plus the kinematical definitions, so Newton's laws, one is called the law of inertia, and that basically, there are different ways to look at it. That basically is how hard is it to get something to move, or a body's motion will, a body will persist in its state of motion unless acted on by a force. So, the other is basically F equals ma, and then the third one is the law of action and reaction. And Newton's laws then basically tells us how the force affects the motion, and once you have acceleration, you will have a velocity and a changing velocity, which will change the position. So x, a, v, and t will all change. When you have all of this stuff together, then it turns out that you can build an infrastructure for actually calculating what will happen to things as a function of time. So when you have all this, you can make calculations or predictions about the motion of objects under the influence of forces. You know, so I think I've probably carefully disguised it enough that it's a bit of a snoozer, but it's actually really important. All right, how do you know when you shoot a gun where the bullet's going to go? Or let's use a more extreme example: if you launch a shell from a cruiser, how do you know where it's going to land? And the only way you know where it's going to land is because you can calculate the force of gravity, the force that's being exerted on the object when it moves, so you know how fast and at what angle it's moving, and then you know what the force of gravity is on it, and then there are probably some calculations that you have to put in for air friction and things like that. But the Navy can take this, you know, this explosive shell and lob it onto some target 30 miles away and hit the damn thing. Right? I mean, it's actually not a trivial thing. It may not seem very exciting, but it is exactly calculations involving all of this, which is why the motion of the ceiling up above you is what it is, which hopefully today is not moving, right? But that doesn't mean there are no forces on it. There's a lot of forces on that thing. But they're all in balance, and that's what mechanical engineers and architects and construction people do, and they work together to ensure that that's all in balance. There are forces all over the place, and if you have some big structural system like this, if one thing goes, the whole thing goes to pieces. I mean, I don't guess I want to remind you of this, but it's probably a vision that we all have. If you recall in 9/11, looking at the World Trade Center as it's on fire and everything, basically things melted enough in there that one or a few small structural members let go somewhere in the middle of the building. And the moment that happened, if you looked at it, the top of the building just sort of crushed right at that point, and then everything just went to pieces, right? I mean, it's so it was all held, we call it static equilibrium, all the mechanical forces. So this is actually turns out to be of great practical importance, and engineers do a whole lot of work trying to make sure that they understand this and dealing with it. At a very much more intellectual point of view, which is sort of the approach I want to use more in this class. In this Newtonian universe that we live in, I call it the deterministic universe. There is no indeterminism in this. If I have a big database of the position of every particle in the universe and its current velocity and what forces are on it, I can predict the future. Yes?
What about like brain activity? Is it that predictable?
No, that's a good question, actually. That depends a little on your thoughts about what brain activity is due to and what it is all about. If you belong in the school that brain activity boils down to basically the chemical interactions and those alone that are happening and the electromagnetic stuff that's going on in the brain, then you might not be able to interpret it. You might not know what it means when the molecules are like this instead of that, but it may actually be a different sort of thought in your brain. In terms of the actual motion of all the crud in your brain and what that may mean for your thought, yeah, completely deterministic. Is that a correct way to look at it? I don't know, because I think you do get emergent properties in complex systems, and life being probably the most blatant example of that, and thought and consciousness. So it is... I'm certainly not going to stand up here and tell you that... that from Newton's laws you could predict life or predict thought necessarily, but I don't think we really understand those emergent properties. So truthfully, given the physics that we know right now, if we don't throw in other things, which we're going to talk a lot about this semester, if the world were truly Newtonian and if thought were really due to positions of everything in your brain, then yeah, it'd be entirely deterministic. So this is a pretty heavy statement, actually. But if we don't get into emergent properties, I can tell you where every meteor and every butterfly is going to be, and that's a pretty big statement. Okay. So you might wonder why people in the financial world aren't here taking more physics, right? Okay. So that's the Newtonian universe and the Newtonian world. What I'd like to do now is to look at it a little more closely than what we typically do. And we've already talked a bit about some of this. So last time we talked about time and space and our vision of what time and space happen to be. So I believe we more or less were comfortable with the fact that time is necessary because of change that we see in the universe around us. And it basically is a way of quantifying it's the fabric in which we measure when things happen relative to one another. Space being sort of the fabric in which we measure where things are. So if we want to describe the universe, which is sort of at the very core of all of science, anything you want to do, one of the things you have to do is, where is it, when is it, and describe it. Our concept of time and our concept of space has to be at the very, very core of that. And it has to be essentially true that if I make a measurement of something, I have to be able to convey with great precision what that measurement was to you so that you can check it against what you saw or create or do the measurement yourself. Okay, that's what science is all about. So this is really at the core of science. The other thing we said was that we do have a vision of space and time, which is at the core of Newtonian physics, which I didn't really say, but it works really well. Okay, Newtonian physics is all you need to be an engineer, for the most part, unless you're doing some really weird stuff. You can build buildings and do airplanes and all this stuff with nothing but Newtonian physics, and it works really well. So it's an enormously successful theory. But the core vision of space and time in Newtonian physics is that we live in three immutable dimensions of space that are orthogonal. We say orthogonal, that's sort of what I mean by independent. We have this way, and that way. Three immutable dimensions of space that are moving lockstep in one direction through time, and we all experience it to be the same, with the caveat that there are different biological variations, because certainly periods in our lives go faster than other periods in terms of our perception. But if you take your watch out, an hour passes for all of us in the same amount of time. Okay? So we're all agreed on that, I hope. All right, and there are lots of implications that come into Newton's laws and motion because of that particular point of view. So let's look at one. Let's suppose that you guys have radar guns and you're able to measure my speed as I'm walking by or running by or something. It's like 4 miles per hour. You might think of it that way. So you see somebody's walking at 4 miles per hour. Let's look at a different example. So the speed with respect to you, if I'm walking past here, would be 4 miles per hour. Let us suppose that we're actually in some airport with a moving sidewalk, all right? And I'm walking at my 4 miles per hour, and there's a moving sidewalk that starts right here, and it is moving at 2 miles per hour that way, okay? I'm walking, I do not break stride, I'm now on the moving sidewalk, how fast am I going with respect to you? 6 miles per hour. That is the right answer, and I'm glad you said it, because you drive. Right? And it, I mean, if you're going at 70 miles per hour and a little old lady is going at 15 miles per hour, you are catching up with her at 55 miles per hour, if I did the algebra right. Right? I mean, so we use this all the time. No surprise. Okay. Now, I want to do exactly the same problem. Okay? But we're going to do it with different things. Let us suppose that light moves at a finite speed, it turns out. It's a very big speed, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. Basically can go in 1 second between New York and San Francisco something like 60 times. So it goes very fast. It takes 8 minutes to get to the sun. It's a known speed. All right. So if I take my laser pointer and I'm standing here and I point it and it shoots out a pulse of light, you can use your fancy light speed measuring device. A radar gun wouldn't quite work, but let's say you happen to have one that's equivalent. You would measure the speed, and it's a big number. We're just going to call it C. So, but C is a constant. It's just a number. All right. And you would measure a very particular value. And you would measure the same value if I shot it this way, and the same value if I shot it that way. You okay with that? All right. Now, I'm in a car. It's going very fast that way. Let's say its speed is V. Okay? Now, I shoot the light. What speed is that light to you?
Still C.
Why?
Because it can't go any faster than the
speed. Okay. I'm walking 4 miles per hour. I'm now on a moving sidewalk. How fast am I going? 4 miles per hour? I don't think so.
It's V plus C.
It has to be. Because otherwise this whole moving sidewalk thing wouldn't work. In the Newtonian world, it is V plus C. If I am in the car and I point it back this way, it's now going C minus V. And here, because of the independence of the directions, you'd just measure C. Okay? Yes?
What about what someone just said back there about how you said like speed of light is...
Well, we'll get there. You guys are blowing my whole punchline. I have to ignore it. Yeah. All right. Now, so I mean, the point I'm trying to make is the answer is obvious what it has to be. And if it were not that, then the world is pretty crazy. Okay? So, people did the obvious thing. They went out and they looked. Okay. See if I want to get into this yet. Maybe I'll come back to this. I don't want to get into this right at the moment. So people went and looked. In particular, two physicists named Michelson and Morley did experiments, and actually the most precise ones were done at Case Western. And in these experiments, they took a source of light and they split the beam of light and basically sent a beam this way and this way. And it turns out that light is a wave-like phenomenon, so you can get some weird things to measure. But basically, if the light moved faster in this direction than it does in that direction, when these two beams recombine, they'd be able to tell it to very high precision. And so they put this sort of stuff on a big slab of stone, basically, so it's very stable, and then they floated that on a pool of mercury, so it was very stable. And then they basically did this measurement as the Earth moved around in all different directions. Because I guess here's light moving, and actually we know that the Earth is moving really fast through space, right? I mean, if we just stop and think about it, we don't even worry about the motion of the sun around the galaxy or the galaxy through whatever. Let's just talk about the Earth moving around the sun. We have a distance of 93 million miles to the sun, okay? And that means the circumference of Earth's orbit is 2 pi times 93 million miles. So that is the distance that you have to go in a year, which is a huge distance. And you divide it by the amount of time in the year, it turns out the Earth is moving at a pretty good clip, right, around the sun. And then the sun is moving even faster, and then, I mean, so it turns out, and astronomers understand this stuff, so they actually know, and they knew even way back when, basically the velocity of the Earth through space, absolute, if you wanted to think about it that way. So you're in your moving car, and you're looking now at the speed of light in different directions, and they found it didn't vary. So in other words, you're in the car and the light going that way and the light going that way are the same. Yeah.
Isn't that speed of light in a vacuum though? Isn't there like a...
It is speed of light in a vacuum.
So the car...
Well, it's actually in air, but close enough. People sort of grow up hearing about this, that the speed of light is a constant and you can't go more than that. I mean, it's just in our culture. But let me impress upon you how bizarre this is. Okay? Basically, well, one example is I'm walking at 4 miles per hour. Now I'm on the moving sidewalk. I haven't broken stride. I'm still moving at 4 miles per hour. With respect to you, you don't see any difference, even though the situation's really quite different. Or you're driving down the interstate at 15 miles per hour and the little old lady is going at 30, or you're driving at 75 and the little lady's going at 30 and your speed with respect to her never changes. I mean, this is completely wacko. Okay, but this is what they saw. Yeah.
In the case of like a moving sidewalk, wouldn't light seem to be slower on Earth because the Earth is moving?
Well, that's what you would expect to see, perhaps. Yeah. You would expect, perhaps, well, it depends on how you look at it. If you think of the light being launched in a mechanical way off the Earth as a platform, then the light will be going faster that way. Just like if I were running hard and throwing a football, it would come out faster, right? I'm sure none of you have done this, but if you've ever gone out throwing beer bottles at mailboxes, if you do that and you're going really fast, you can really take out the mailbox, and all you have to do is toss the beer bottle out, right? I'm sure you all relate to this. Yes.
So the light is still the fastest thing? I mean, from what you're saying, it seems like the fastest form of light would be, I don't know, light coming from a really fast moving sun, something like that.
Well, that would be Newtonian physics. Yeah. But that's not what these guys are saying. These guys are saying it's the same speed no matter what its source is or how it's moving. Yeah.
So they're saying that you give the example about, you know, if you're changing your speed in relation to the little, you know, to the old one about the car 30 miles an hour, they're saying you're not changing your speed relative to it?
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that whether I am standing still shooting this beam of light or whether I am going really, really fast and shooting this beam of light, you would measure the same speed. And I would measure the same speed.
But maybe light, is it possible that light just has completely different properties?
Yeah, it's very possible. And that's sort of the core of it, I think. And we're going to talk a lot about that. But that's, light at the time was understood to be a, we're going to talk about the essence of light. It's thought to be effectively a mechanical wave in a substance which we call ether. And if that were the case, it would have motion just like water waves. I mean, think about water waves. If I throw a big rock into a pond, then the waves have a certain motion with respect to me. Okay, let's just worry about the waves that are going out that way. If I'm running very fast, relative to me, those waves might be frozen, right? Or if I go even faster, they can go backwards. So if you think of light in that way, then your motion, the speed of light, has to vary with respect to your motion. So I see a few hands up here. There was one over here. Yeah.
So when you're walking on the moving sidewalk, are you actually going 4 miles an hour or 6 miles an hour?
With respect to you, I'd be going 6 miles per hour. Really? Yeah.
So the example you just gave with the weight for the water, is that similar to a car wheel, and that when you watch it, it's going forward, but then as it gets faster and faster, it goes backward?
I don't know. I have to think about it. I don't think those are related, but I don't know. I have to think about the whole car wheel thing, even actually how it works. Maybe more of an optical illusion with the timing of how things are rotating and what you're perceiving. I'm talking about a very real relative motion. I mean, if you're running fast along the side of a pond, you actually can't outrun the water wave, right? I think the car wheel is still turning, but there are structures on the car wheel which, if it's going a certain speed, don't make it quite around. I mean, somehow it may have to do with your perception. I'm not sure. I know how to answer that, but yes.
So does like having a constant speed kind of go with like not having any mass?
And when light goes from one medium to another, does it accelerate?
Its velocity changes, actually, when it goes from one. But pretend we're just talking about light in a vacuum right now. And because its velocity changes, I guess you can think of it as accelerating right at the interface. But particles without any mass do basically move at the speed of light, that is irrelevant for the point we're trying to make right now, which is the fact that this speed doesn't seem to change with respect to its motion with respect to you. Whether you're measuring it from a rocket ship or from standing still with respect to the source of light, you would see it moving at the same speed. So, yeah.
Has this been tried over greater distances? Because maybe, I don't know if light accelerates or something, because...
It has been tried over large distances. I mean, people have done very precise experiments on this, so it does appear to be the case. So, let me actually go on a bit, because it's this is sort of just the setup for the fun stuff. It turned out, and we're going to get into the essence of light, so we'll come back to what I'm really saying right now, but light was thought of as a mechanical oscillation of, I'll just say, electric and magnetic fields, and what that means we'll come back to, in a substance which we called ether, which was called ether because it's sort of ethereal. You couldn't feel it or smell it or see it, yet light had to move on it because light was known to be a wave. And what I mean by that, again, we'll come back to. Physicists were pretty confident in the wave-like characteristics of light, and the only types of waves we knew about were mechanical waves, like a string vibrating or waves on water or something like that. So they created a similar model with light. And yet light had this really strange property that if it's a mechanical wave, then the whole idea of the relative velocities, like in the Newtonian world, the 4 miles per hour, the 6 miles per hour, has to hold true. If it didn't hold true, I mean, imagine what life would be like on the interstate or playing football or whatever. I mean, the whole world in which we live would just be completely wacko if that weren't true. So people really didn't like this, and they made up ways in which to save their model. So, for example, they had the idea that it's the relative motion through the ether that's important, or in the case of the pond, it's me moving with respect to the pond that causes this velocity to change. So, for example, if the Earth, as it moves through this ether, sort of had a bit of friction with the ether and basically pulled some of the ether with it, then that ether would not be moving with respect to the surface of the Earth, and you wouldn't see the effect of the motion of the Earth through the ether. So there were very complicated models people were coming up with to try to save the day. So along came this guy, Einstein, and Einstein certainly has this reputation of being an absolutely brilliant physicist, and hands down he was. It turns out, though, that one of his defining characteristics was not so much that he could see a more complex world than the rest of us. It was that he had a way of seeing the simplicity. He could see the forest in spite of the trees, I guess is a way to say it. Or is it the other way around? I may have that saying wrong. At any rate, Einstein said, okay, you know, yeah, this is completely wacko, but science is all about experiment. The experiment is saying this is the way it is. Why don't we just assume this is the way it is and then ask what follows from that? So Einstein's special theory of relativity was based on two postulates. One postulate is that this experiment is simply correct and that the speed of light is the same in all inertial reference frames, which is a very fancy way of saying moving at a constant speed, not accelerating. And then he made another really insightful assumption, which is that the physics is the same in all inertial reference frames. So what do I really mean by that? A reference frame is like the point of view. So when I said my speed with respect to you, I was really saying, a physicist would say, measured in your reference frame, okay, from your point of view. So these are the two assumptions that underlie special relativity. And they're basically both sort of no-brainers. One is, okay, the experiment's right, whatever it is. And the other is physics is the same in all inertial references. What do I mean by that? I mean, if somebody is standing here and they drop an egg, it falls and it breaks on the floor. You would see that if you were sitting there from your point of view, and if I were driving by in a car at a high speed, I would see the egg break too. Neither of us, because of our point of view, are not going to see the egg break. The egg's going to fall and break, okay? So whatever events happen have to happen for everybody, basically, okay? So that's the second. And again, that's just sort of a no-brainer, right? Well, yeah. You okay with this? Yes?
So then if nobody sees it?
Well, then the event didn't happen, or... Okay, we could get into the, does the tree fall if nobody's there to see it? And I'm not trying to get into that, but yeah. I'm going to assume something happens, and if something happens, then we both see it. Everybody sees it. Okay, so now what I'd like to do are just a couple little thought experiments to help us look at the implications of these two postulates. Let's suppose that we have a... we'll call it a train car or something, a truck going by, and it has a transparent side, and it has a height which is fixed to be large h, and the thing moves with velocity v. And we're going to say that there is an event that happens, and that event is that a beam of light, a pulse of light, is emitted from this point, bounces off a mirror up here, and comes back down to that same point on the truck, okay? You all right with that? I'd like to look at this event from two different points of view or reference frames. The first reference frame is from the point of view of Sam, who happens to be sitting on the train itself. Sam is sitting right here by this, the place where the light is emitted. And Sam has phenomenal reflexes and a really good stopwatch. Okay, so Sam starts his stopwatch at the moment the light is emitted and stops it at the moment the light comes back to the floor. Okay, and that will be the amount of time Sam perceives this event to take. The event being light emitted, bounce, come back, and hits the floor. You okay with that? So let's see what Sam sees. Sam sees the light travel a distance h up, a distance h back. What is speed? Speed is distance over time. So the speed of light is a number, same for everybody, according to Einstein. Is distance over time. What's the distance? It's 2 times h divided by the time that Sam measures. So based on Sam's measurement, this is the speed of light. Or if you want to ask what time does Sam measure, it has to be 2h over c. You okay with that? I want to look at exactly the same event. It's happening at exactly the same time, but now we want to look at it from the point of view of someone who is beside the road, who is looking at this thing as it goes past them at velocity v. And the person will be Sally, because when you do relativity problems, it always has to be Sam and Sally. Don't ask me why. So Sally now is to the side of the road as the truck goes by. And Sally, the same thing, the light is emitted, she starts her watch, and the light comes back, and she stops her watch. Now, what does Sally actually see? Because light moves at a finite speed, and let us assume the truck is going very fast, and Sally has superpowers and good reflexes. So what happens is, as the light is emitted, the truck actually moves as the light is traveling up to the mirror. So from Sally's point of view, the light must travel this path. You okay with that? All right. And then it comes back. Again, as it's coming back, the truck moves. So Sally perceives this to be the path of the light. Both of them have a height h. So this height is the same as that height. Which one moves further?
Yeah. I have a question. Is the light source is on the bottom of the truck? It's attached. It's not on the ground. The truck's driving over this.
You can think of the source and the detection element at the bottom is moving with the truck. Yeah.
So it's H, the height's H for both.
Yeah.
Then it moves the same distance.
No. Can't. This is the height H. So if I move from here up to here and back down to here, okay. That's this distance.
The arrows are the same.
No, they're not. This is longer.
Okay.
Yeah. So Sally sees the light to travel further. That's what she perceives. Has to. If the speed of light is the same for both of them, and Sally sees the light travel further in the same time, then time must pass at different speeds for the two observers. More time must pass for Sally than for Sam in order for the distance divided by that time to equal the same number. Does that bother you? That's a statement that the passage of time is relative, not absolute. It depends on your relative motion. If we all synchronize our watches and leave for an hour and come back, what the watches will say will depend on what you did for that hour. If somebody got on a very fast jet, it turns out their watch will be running a little slower than the rest of ours would. Yes?
Have there been experiments that prove this?
To Nat's eyebrow precision.
Right.
All right. I'm about to go through some numbers and tell you why this isn't something you need to worry about when you're commuting to work or whatever. But, yes?
How slight is the disparity?
Let's just do that. Okay, so this is just purely conceptual. Let's actually look at some numbers. All right. So we have triangle formed. This is a distance H. This distance is the distance the truck goes in the amount of time Sally is measuring. So that's the speed of the truck, the V that we've had, times Sally's time. That would be this total distance. So if I want to think about this triangle all by itself, this side is H. This side is 1/2 times VT because it's half this total distance. And I want to ask for Sally, what is this distance? Because remember, it's the distances of those rays that turns out to be important. This distance D, if we use Pythagorean's theorem, if you remember that, it would be the square of this distance is equal to the sum of the square of this one plus that one. And so if I just take advantage of that, D squared is equal to H squared plus 1/2 VT squared, and then I can take the square root of this side, and I end up with D being the square root of H squared plus 1/2 VT squared. So that's what the geometry tells us for Sally. That's the distance. So we can look at what Sally thinks the speed of light should be, and it should be the total distance things went, which is 2 times that D, because of the two sides of that triangle, divided by the time that she measures. And that has to be equal to C, because Einstein says it has to be the same speed as the other point of view. Okay, so now there's some annoying algebra. This will be posted on the web. You can go through it. It really is like seventh grade algebra, though. This is equal to C. This is equal to C. I can set them equal to one another. And now, algebraically, try to find how Sam's time and Sally's time are related. And this is a bit annoying. You can go through it. It's not like I'm going to give you anything like this on an exam. But you might have fun going through it because this isn't like high-powered college calculus. This is seventh grade algebra. Annoying, but seventh grade algebra. When you do this bit of algebra, okay, you end up with this expression, that the time that Sally measures relative to the time that Sam measures is given by this expression. There is this piece that ends up coming up in front of Sam. Okay? This piece turns out to be the critical piece, and we call it gamma. So we have a bit of algebra, we end up with this. Okay. Let's look at that number. Let's look at this. It is 1 divided by the square root of 1 minus this quantity squared. This is the velocity of the truck divided by the speed of light. The speed of light is really, 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 really big. No truck we have goes very fast. So this number is really small in normal life. Therefore, 1 minus a number that's basically 0 is just 1. The square root of 1 is 1. 1 over 1 is 1. So the time that Sam measures and the time that Sally measures should be the same in the limit of normal life, because we don't have things that have speeds that are a big fraction of the speed of light. Okay? If the truck is going a large fraction of the speed of light, on the other hand, then this v is like, you know, let's say it's 90% the speed of light. It's 0.9 times c. 0.9 times c over c is just 0.9 in here. Squared is whatever it is, okay, 0.7 or whatever, 0.8. 1 minus 0.8 is 0.2. The square root of 0.2 is a real number. 1 minus, so you end up with a number that's greater than 1 here. The bigger this v is, the smaller this denominator is, and the bigger this number becomes altogether. In the circumstances where the relative velocity between Sam and Sally is a large fraction of the speed of light, they do not measure the same time passing. In fact, it can be very different. In other words, Sally's time and Sam's time can really pass at very different rates. Yes?
It's maybe a little ridiculous, but like, what if B was equal to C?
Well, that's a good question. If you start with something that's less than the speed of light and you try to reach the speed of light and you look at this, it turns out it would take an infinite energy to get it to go that fast. So you can't quite get there. Yeah, so it's basically not possible, although you can go very fast. I mean, if you go to our very, very powerful particle accelerators, particles are going at very close to the speed of light, like, you know, 99.99999999 whatever percent of the speed of light. You can get really close, but you don't get there with a massive particle. Okay, so the point here is that in the limit of things that are going very fast relative to the speed of light, something that's going a big fraction of the speed of light, this is a very observable effect. Okay, but even an F-16 isn't going, I mean, it's going a tiny fraction of the speed of light. So, in everyday life, the world in which we live, Sally's time, Sam's time, they're equal to one another. The universe is much richer than that, though, because there are things that go much faster. And to understand those, you have to use this formula, it turns out. So, as strange as it seems, time is relative in the universe. And people have done experiments with this. So let's talk about just how weird this can be. You can take two synchronized clocks, put one on an airplane, send the airplane around the world, have it come back, and sure enough, the clock that was on the airplane, less time will have elapsed than the clock that was on the ground. People have measured it. in particle physics experiments where you have these big accelerators, the relativistic effects are huge, and they are measured with high precision, and they happen. So let's talk about just how weird this can be. Let us make up something. Let us suppose that we have a rocket ship that is moving at a constant speed, but that speed is 98% the speed of light, passing by Earth, okay? Let's pretend the Earth is at rest. And let us say that we have astronomers on Earth who are looking at this spaceship, and the spaceship is a big spaceship, and people do what they do, so babies are born and everything. And so they see a baby born on the spaceship, which they could tell because the blue balloons go up in the windows of the spacecraft, and there's a sign that comes up that says, it's a boy, okay? So the astronomers on Earth then write down on the calendar, boy born on spacecraft, okay? It's a boy, name of Sam or whatever. Yeah, because Sam was on the truck, so Sam can be on the spaceship. So let us suppose that as this spaceship goes along, Sam lives a wonderful, happy life insofar as you can live it encapsulated on a little spaceship, okay? And let's suppose that Sam lives a life of a fulfilling life of 70 years on this spaceship, okay? What do the astronomers on Earth see? On the spaceship, 70 years after Sam is born, you throw the wake and somebody puts black balloons in the window. The astronomers on Earth see this and they mark it down on the calendar. How much time has passed on Earth? Yes?
70 plus 98% of 70?
No, it's more complicated than that, but let's see what it is. So you use this relativistic formula, this weird quantity we call gamma. We call it gamma, so we don't have to say 1 over square root of 1 minus b over c is quantity squared. This is the formula that relates it. It comes out of special relativity. It comes out of the thinking that we just did. This is the time that was on the spaceship at 70 years. This quantity at 98% the speed of light is no longer 1. It's 5, which means on Earth, people would measure this to have taken 350 years. On Earth, we would perceive time to be moving much more slowly on this spaceship. Yes?
So, if you could, see through the spaceship at, all times, and, you were watching, would it look like they're moving in slow motion, or...? Okay.
But they wouldn't perceive it that way. To them, this is how weird it gets. To them, everything looks normal, and Earth is traveling at 98% the speed of light the other way. And if they look at Earth, everything would seem to move slowly. They're both right. There was a hand? Yes.
What if you had a video camera feeding back from one to the other? What would each side? Would it be different from just looking straight?
Well, now you have to see what time frame, what frame of reference is the video camera in.
Yeah.
If the astronomers on Earth are taking a video shot of the spaceship, they would see everything moving 5 times slower than what they would normally think. Time literally moves slower.
What if it's like a simultaneous beam?
Well, the people on the spaceship would perceive it the other way. It's pretty weird. I don't know. Yes?
So, just to make sure I understand what you're saying. Say, the spaceship was Skyping Earth. So they're both, the webcams are, one of them's on the spaceship, one of them's on Earth. People on the spaceship would see people on Earth moving really slowly.
You would be on Earth and you would hear, well, hello.
You wouldn't really see anything because you're moving at 98% of the speed of light.
Everything moves, yeah. It's really, really strange. Is it real? Yeah, it's actually real. Now, you get into some pretty weird things, and I don't have time to talk about some of the paradoxes. We'll try to do that Monday. But let me just give you a sense of how real this is. There's a particle. We have particles from the outer space that are hitting the top of the atmosphere all the time. They're called cosmic rays, and most of them are coming from the sun. When they hit the top of the atmosphere, they create other particles. And among those particles they create are particles called muons. If I had a pile of muons right here, just sitting right here, they basically would live for 1 microsecond before they would decay into other things. And if you ask how long it takes for a muon to come from the top of the atmosphere down to Earth, it takes longer than 1 microsecond. So we shouldn't see muons hitting the surface of the Earth from this stuff hitting the top of the atmosphere. But you do. They're going through you all the time. And the only way that that happens is they live for 1 microsecond, but because they're going so fast, to us, that 1 microsecond seems like a much longer time. So when we calculate how far they go in our reference frame, they go much further than they would otherwise. And this is not, I mean, this, you have to know this to understand the flux or the number of these muons hitting the surface of the Earth. It's a very real effect. That's just one example. And I mean, we deal with it every day. I guess I have to stop there. We'll come back and talk about some of the weird things in special relativity on Monday.